I would imagine there are some of you in this room who might have been planning on retiring this year who are no longer planning to do that. With 30% of the market having dropped out, you're probably looking for that 30% in your 401ks right about now, wondering what in the world happened to it. If you've been watching the stock market, it's been quite a fascinating and depressing week. And I imagine there are people all over the United States, and perhaps even in this classroom right now, who may be asking a question like this: what in the world is God doing? Or rather, why isn't God doing something? Why is God being so passive? Why is God being so silent? Why is God apparently standing behind the scenes and not acting? It may be that you're asking that question because of what's happened to the economy recently. I would imagine in the first week of November, 50% of Americans are going to wake up extremely happy with what happened on the evening of November 4th. 50% of Americans are going to wake up and wonder, where in the world is God? So that regardless of which candidates you're going to support, some are going to wake up wondering, why in the world did God let this happen? Others are going to wake up proclaiming that finally God has risen and actually done something. It may not be either the economy for you all, or it may not be the political situation. Maybe you all had your money at this time, hopefully in some financial assets of the bond market rather than the stock market, so you're sitting a little bit healthier this morning. Maybe for you, you're struggling with something in your family. Maybe you've got a struggle with your spouse, and you're wondering, why doesn't God care? Why is he passive? Why isn't he being active? Why doesn't he rise up and do something? Maybe it's one of your kids. Maybe you're looking at one of your children and wondering, why hasn't God done something? Doesn't God care? Why is he so passive? Why is he failing to act? Why is God just sitting on his hands in his heavenly couch somewhere and not doing something about this situation? It may be your child. It may be your spouse. It may be yourself. Maybe you just had a doctor's appointment this weekend, and you found out something that you didn't expect and didn't want. And so maybe you're sitting here this morning, you were just barely able to get in that elevator, and you were just barely able to come into this class, and you really don't want to be around us right now, because you're wondering how God could be so inactive, how God could be so uncaring, how God could just really not want to do something for you. I don't know what your particular situation is, but there's enough going on in our economy. There's enough going on in our political situation. There's enough going on in our private lives to give each and every one of us enough reasons not to get out of bed in the morning. Maybe some of you struggled with that this morning. Maybe some of you, when the alarm went off, you just wanted to pull the blankets up back over your head, close your eyes, curl into a fetal position, and just say, you know what, I just can't do it again. You know what, to all of us who might be feeling that way about something, Moses wants you to know something about God. And it's fascinating. He wants you to know about it in Genesis chapter 2. I hope as we look at the second chapter of Genesis this morning and in the next few weeks, you'll see God in a way perhaps in which you have never seen him before. That Moses will tell you something about God that comes out and smacks you right up against the head, where instead of saying, I should have had a V8, what you're going to say is, I should have always kept that in mind about God. I love V8 juice. I am a V8 juice fan. I'll drink a bottle of V8 any time of day, any time of night. I'm such a V8 fan. I've even started their soups. Y'all seen the advertisements on TV for the new V8 soups? Well, they're not all they're supposed to be, I'll tell you that. But I'm still a fan of their juice. And I absolutely love the juice. I go to their juice so when I want a snack that's not filling and it's fat-free. And many a time that I'll say, boy, I'm glad that can of V8, that bottle of V8 was around. It takes the edge off of my hunger. It satisfies me when I want something a little bit salty. It calms me down. It nourishes me, and I feel good that I've actually eaten or had something to drink that was healthy. I hope that when we leave class this morning, regardless of what trauma has descended upon you, maybe it's been with you for years, that when we leave class this morning, you're going to go, that is really some special God that has entered into a relationship with me. Genesis chapter 2. The heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. That's enough for this morning. That's as far as we're going to go. Because at the very beginning of Genesis chapter 2, God introduces to us something about God that we can so easily miss. Read it with me one more time. Thus the heavens and the earth were completed in all their vast array. By the seventh day, God had finished the work he had been doing. So on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And God blessed the seventh day and made it holy, because on it he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. I want you to see a word that appears in those few verses several times. Did you all catch it? Verse 2, God had finished the work he had been doing. And then again, so on the seventh day, he rested from all his work. And then the last phrase, verse 3, he rested from all the work of creating that he had done. I'm sorry, how many verses did we just look at? Just 3. And I want you to notice that right smack dab up front, as he introduces us to the next part of the story, Moses is throwing this word at you almost in an annoying, kind of can't get at the itch sort of way. He just throws this word at you 3 times, and he puts it right before your face so you can't miss it. And I want you to see a word that he also throws in there. Notice the last phrase of verse 2. He rested. And I want you to see the last phrase of verse 3. He rested. And notice the first line of verse 2. God had finished. Do you see what Moses is doing here? At the very beginning of Genesis chapter 2, he is taking 2 words, 2 concepts, 2 ideas, and he is putting them against each other. The first word is this word work. And he wants you to see that God is a working, that God is a God who gets his hands dirty. God is a God who actually rolls up his sleeve and just pours himself into an activity. But then Moses also wants you to see another word. He wants you to see that there comes a time in which God's work is finished, and then a time in which God has rested. I'm wondering if there are people in our world and if there are people in this room who are wondering if God is taking a break right about now. I'm wondering if some of you wonder if God has decided to take a siesta in your life. And that God is a God who is active for so long, maybe in somebody else's life, maybe in somebody else's economy, but he's decided that this is the time in which he's going to wipe the sweat from his brow, find a shady tree and a glass of lemonade and put his feet up. Somebody is looking at this passage and just wondering if God has finally decided to take some time off. I want you to see what Moses is doing. He is characterizing that God is a working God, and yet he is also stating that God is a God who values rest. As a matter of fact, notice what he does with the seventh day here. He blesses the seventh day and makes it holy. Now, to make something holy in the Hebrew world of thought is really quite something. It's quite spectacular. To make something holy first of all, of course, it's not to make it appear like a piece of Swiss cheese, right? To make something holy is not to remove something from it. To make something holy is to set it aside, to set it apart. It's to separate it from everything else so that it's distinct, exclusive, and unique. There is something about it that makes it unlike everything else. That's what the word holy really means. When something is holy, there is something about it that makes it different from anything else. Let me give you some other words for holy. They may not be as familiar to you, but peculiar. Peculiar is a good English synonym for holy. When something is holy, it's peculiar. It stands out. I remember when Pamela and I were in Venice, and we found this very charming side road restaurant. And of course, when you're in Venice, you want to go after the seafood, and so indeed we did. And I remember that what I ordered up was a bowl of spaghetti, but this was a very particular kind of spaghetti. This was spaghetti with a squid. But it wasn't spaghetti just with squid, but it was spaghetti with squid cooked in its own ink. Oh, how disappointing. It's spaghetti with squid cooked in its own ink. And so it arrived at the table in a bowl, and it looked like spaghetti immersed into a black inky soup. And can you imagine my poor wife sitting there having something normal like pizza or lasagna, and here her husband is the only one, all right, in the entire roadside restaurant having the squid cooked in its own ink. And when I was finished, my teeth were stained black, my lips were black, and I was dripping black ink juice from my chin. I was being holy at that meal. I was being peculiar. I was standing out. Something about my meal made me different. Where you were unable to confuse me with Pamela, where you were unable to confuse me with anybody else in the restaurant, because Bingham was the one who was eating something peculiar. Something that was different, separate, set apart from what everybody else was eating. And what the Lord does here is he blesses the day, the seventh one, and he sets it apart. He declares that it's going to be peculiar, that it's going to stand out, that it's going to be odd, that it's going to be different. As a matter of fact, he thinks this so much. Keep a finger there in Genesis chapter 2, but pop over to the book of Exodus. The book of Exodus is the book right after the book of Genesis, and look at verse 20. He thinks so much of this peculiar day. Notice what he does with it and what he says about it in verse 8. Exodus chapter 20 and verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day by keeping it peculiar, by keeping it holy, by keeping it different, by keeping it set apart. 6 days you shall labor and do all your, there's that word again, work. But the seventh day is a Sabbath to the Lord your God. On it you shall do no work, neither you nor your son or your daughter, nor your manservant or maidservant, nor your animals, Grace, you'll be happy to hear this, nor the alien within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth, the sea and all that is in them, but he rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day and made it holy. Made it peculiar. As a matter of fact, what he did was to take a piece of poster board, draw a red circle on it, and then draw a red slash through the circle. And in the middle of the circle, he wrote the word work. No work. No work. 6 days shall my creatures labor, but on the seventh day, there won't be any work, because I've already set this pattern forth in creation. There is work, there is labor, but then there is a time in which the labor shall cease. And by the way, the labor shall cease, and you shall make doggone sure that the labor ceases, because I have blessed a particular day, and I have declared that you should make it peculiar. You see what the Creator is doing here? The Creator is looking out for his own. The Creator, as a matter of fact, builds it into the very structure of creation. He doesn't need to rest. He doesn't get tired. He doesn't get weary. Sweat never pops out of his brow, and his hands never get tired and achy. He never has a sore back. He never feels weakness in his legs. But what he does is, in order to establish this information about himself, he rests on the seventh day. He wants you to see that he is so, well, in touch with your needs, that he is so conscious of the fact that you become weary. He is so conscious of the fact that you get out of breath. He's so conscious of the fact that some days you can't get out of bed another day. You can't walk into that office one more time. You can't walk into that kitchen again. He is so conscious of the fact that you get doggone tired, fed up, and sick of things, that he built it into the very structure of creation. And as a matter of fact, in the list of commandments that he's made, he has stood up and he has said, you know what? I command it. I order it. I set this day apart, and I call it holy, and I give you a command. I am so conscious of the fact that you get so weary that you're going to set apart one day in which you yourself recognize your weariness and in which you can sit down and rest. I care so much about you that you may not want to do it for yourselves. You may feel that, and you may be so compulsive that you've got to keep just going at it and going at it and going at it. He says, I know better than that. I know what and who you are, that I am going to regulate the fact that you need to sit down, take care of yourselves, and rest and become refreshed. He is so concerned about your refreshment, he is so concerned about your renewal, that he builds it into the very structure of creation, and he makes it a regulation, he makes it a commandment. And, you know, the Jews did something evil with this. The Jews took a blessing, and the Jews corrupted it. And they their teachers and their lawmakers, they forgot that the Sabbath day was a blessing, and they laid it as a day of burden upon the people. So that that which God had initiated and built into the very structure of creation as something that should be blessed, something that should indicate to us the degree to which God cares about us and wants to bring relief to us, they took what God meant for relief and they made it a burden. Notice what happens in the life of Isaiah. Come with me to Isaiah chapter 58. It had become so twisted and so perverted by the time that Isaiah writes about it. Notice what Isaiah has to remind us of in verse 13 of chapter 58 of his prophecy. Isaiah 58 and verse 13. If you keep your feet from breaking the Sabbath and from doing as you please on my holy day, if you call the Sabbath a delight and the Lord's holy day honorable, and if you honor it by not going your own way and not doing as you please or speaking idle words, then you will find joy in the Lord, and I will cause you to ride on the heights of the land and to feast on the inheritance of your father Jacob. The mouth of the Lord has spoken. You see, Isaiah has to reintroduce God's concern for the Sabbath day here at the end of the 58th chapter, and he's got to introduce it as something that God has instituted for the benefit of humanity, because human beings like to do their own thing. As a matter of fact, human beings like to do their own thing so much that they run themselves into the ground. Human beings like to do their own thing so much that they will destroy themselves. Human beings like to take such control of their lives and to become so set on producing their own fruit that they will ultimately destroy themselves. What God has to say to Isaiah is, look, you all have become so focused on doing things your own way. You've decided to take control of your own life, of your own words. So notice what he says again. If you call the Sabbath day a delight, if you honor it by not going your own way and not doing as you please or speaking idle words. The second reason why God introduces the Sabbath day into creation is this. In order to remind you that your relationship with him is not about going about doing what you want to do or saying what you want to do. The Sabbath is there to remind you that as much as you may want to labor, as much as you think that you can just keep on going, as much as you think you can keep doing it your way, as strong as you think you are, as energetic as you think you are, you think that you actually have the capability to just keep on doing it your way. He inspires Isaiah to remind us that what the Sabbath is all about is reminding us that it's not about our own way. That the Sabbath day, and the reason why God set it apart, was in order to orchestrate into the very substance of creation that we are to do things the way of the Creator. We are not to do things our own way. The Sabbath is a time for us to say, you know what, I'm not as smart as I think I am. I'm not as powerful as I think I am. I'm not as energetic as I think I am. I don't have it in me to just keep on going. I am a weak, I am a puny, I am a pitiful creature, and I desperately need the assistance and the intervention of God, because I'm not as strong as I think I am. And God has to remind me and to keep telling me that I lack the self-sufficiency that I think I might have. The Jews took that which was holy, which was set apart, and they corrupted it into something else. Look what else they did with it. Turn with me to the Gospels, where we see the Lord Jesus talking about the Sabbath. Matthew chapter 12. Matthew 12 and verse 1. At that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath. His disciples were hungry and began to pick some heads of grain and eat them. When the Pharisees saw this, they said to him, "Look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath." He answered, "You knuckleheads." That's in the original Greek, but sometimes it's not carried across into your English translations. You may want to put a little asterisk there and say some ancient sources read, "You knuckleheads," right? He answered, "Haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests. Or haven't you read in the law that on the Sabbath the priests in the temple desecrate the day and yet are innocent? I tell you that one greater than the temple is here. If you had known what these words mean, 'I desire mercy, not sacrifice,' you would not have condemned the innocent. For the Lord, for the Son of Man, is the Lord of the Sabbath." You see, Jesus in this activity reintroduces into the Jewish culture what was manifested to us by God's creation of this day, by God's blessing of this day, the Sabbath. He set it apart in order to be merciful, in order to be kind, in order to introduce something into our lives from the very fabric of creation which we so desperately needed. The Sabbath is a day of God's merciful initiative. It is the Creator being merciful and kind, being compassionate and renewing. But what the Jews had done is they had corrupted it into a day in which it had become no longer a blessing, but a curse. And so Jesus stands up and he says, "Don't you know I desire mercy, not sacrifice? And by the way, I am the Lord of the Sabbath." Here Jesus Christ is standing up before the Jews and he is declaring that he is the very God who blessed the Sabbath. He is the very God who set the Sabbath apart. He is the God who in the very initiating moment of the Sabbath had revealed himself as one who cares for us so much that he sets a day apart for our own renewal, our own refreshment, so that he can be merciful to us and kind to us in this way. Notice Mark chapter 2. It's the next gospel over. Mark chapter 2, it's going to be the same old story again. The Jews have corrupted this day again. Notice verse 23, Mark 2 and 23. "One Sabbath, Jesus was going through the grain fields, and as his disciples walked along, they began to pick some heads of grain. The Pharisees said to him, 'Look, why are you doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath?' He answered, 'You dimwits. Have you never read what David did when he and his companions were hungry and in need? In the day of Abiathar the high priest, he entered the house of God and ate the consecrated bread, which is unlawful for the priest to eat, and he also gave some to his companions. Then he said to them, "The Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. So the Son of Man is Lord even of the Sabbath." The Sabbath was made for you, not you for the Sabbath. In other words, the Lord orchestrated and manifested himself as one who cares for his creatures, knows what his creatures need, and provides within the very fabric of the creative structure rest for his creatures. In other words, here is the seventh day of creation with a megaphone, and it is screaming and yelling out, "Look at how much God cares for you." It is part of the warp and the woof of your week. It's part of the warp and woof of your timekeeping. It's part of the warp and woof of your calendars. It's unable to be escaped. God introduced the Sabbath in order to make this declaration. I care about you so much that I'm going to institute something which you desperately need, because without me you wouldn't do it for yourselves. This is how much I care. You may think that I don't care. You may think that I'm absent. You may think that I'm deaf. You may think that I'm dumb. You may think that I'm not doing what I need to do. But I want to remind you of what I did at the very beginning, God says to us this morning. I cared so much about you that I worked into the very fabric of things the fact that I am merciful, and the fact that I created something just for you. Of course, in Christianity, we are not commanded to keep the Sabbath. But what the Sabbath does is continue to remind us of how forethinking God is about our needs. So much so, look with me at Hebrews chapter 4. Way towards the back of the Bible, get through all of Paul's writings. Just keep on a flipping, and you'll eventually stumble right into Hebrews, right after 2nd, right after Titus. Notice Hebrews chapter 4 and verse 1. He's talking about the Sabbath rest, and but what I want you to see is a verse that comes in verse 8. For if Joshua had given them rest, God would not have spoken later about another day. There remains then a Sabbath rest for the people of God. For anyone who enters God's rest also rests from his own work, just as God did from his. Let us therefore make every effort to enter that rest, so that no one will fall by following their example of disobedience. What the writer to the Hebrews wants us to know this morning is that what was introduced at the very beginning of creation was just a small, small taste of what is awaiting us at the end of God's redemptive work. The writer to the Hebrews is saying there is a day coming which is going to be the true and complete Sabbath, which is going to be the true and fulfilled promise of God to give His people rest, to give His people release from their sins, to give His people release from death, to give His people release from mourning, to give His people release from the struggles and the emotional pain and the trauma that is connected with being a mother and a father, a husband and a wife, a child and a neighbor, that is being all the trauma that is associated with living as we live here, with our bank accounts falling, our 401ks ending up being disastrously underpriced and undervalued. The Lord says what I introduced back in Genesis chapter 2 is something that I will only ultimately bring to fulfillment in the future when my time returns. What I want you to see this morning is that from the very beginning of creation in Genesis chapter 2 to the very end of His redemptive work, God has always been thinking about you. He has been obsessed with something, and He has been obsessed with bringing you rest and refreshment. Sometimes in this life, God is going to surprise you, and He is going to bring you rest and refreshment from something you never thought you were going to get rest and refreshment from. There are other things in this life which you will have to struggle with until you meet the Lord in the air. All of us, however, are heading towards a time in which God will give us complete relief from those things with which we struggle today. I want you to know that day is coming, but more than that, I want you to see the God who, even in the midst of your worst troubles, has always been obsessed with being merciful, kind, and providing for you what you need, even when you don't know it, see it, feel it, smell it, or touch it. Can we leave the room this morning just reminded of the fact God knows our need. God has worked into the structure the provision of our need. He may not give us rest and relaxation from what is bothering us and the work that is overcoming us today, but the rest and the refreshment is going to be there. And God knows exactly what you need, and in His timing, He'll provide it. So, Father, as we live in a world in which Your voice and Your hands seem to be silent and invisible, we give You thanks that from the very beginning You have thought of us. From the very beginning You have been concerned with being merciful to us. And in the very end, You will give us complete and utter refreshment and rest. Strengthen us with courage in the present. Help us to find our rest in our faith in You. For You are trustworthy and You are true. You are mighty and You are strong. We ask it through the Son and by the Spirit.